It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In less than 3 months, Pennsylvanians will go to the polls. Allegheny County has contracted with ESS to provide a state-mandated paper trail for the ballots that are cast. I visited County Executive Rich Fitzgerald in his office yesterday.
Most of the state has been on a mission to update its voting processes, its machines, if you would, ahead of the 2020 contest. Pennsylvania's primary is April 28th. Will Allegheny County's new process be ready by then?
Yes, and there's going to be an awful lot of training, in essence, that'll go on, not just from the poll workers themselves, but also the voters. We're going to do a lot of outreach because it's going to be a new voting system that we're going to be working under. People are going to be voting on paper ballots that will be recountable, and you know, you'll be able to go back and do a recount, those type of things. There's also early voting that was passed in Act 77, which allows people to vote, I should say, vote by mail at an earlier time. No excuse absentee voting, I guess, is the best way to say that. But there are going to be changes, and I think it's incumbent upon all of us to try to communicate those changes to make the voting process, both in April and in November, as smooth as we can make it.
The paper votes, the paper trail, after what happened in Iowa, are you glad that's going to be a built-in feature?
Well, and yes and no. The other thing that makes it challenging is the election departments around the state are not allowed to start counting the ballots until after the polls close. So when we are used to getting results around 9, 9:30, maybe 10 o'clock, this could be a very, very late night till we can get results, particularly out of heavy turnout areas like your big counties like Philadelphia, Allegheny, Montgomery County. So we're hoping there could be some changes. Otherwise, you may be getting results in the middle of the night, and that's not anything that most of us in Pennsylvania have been used to.
Do we have enough poll workers? I think we need somewhere around 6,600 poll workers.
Well, that's always been a challenge because you're right. We have 1,300 polling places that precincts that people can vote at, 5 poll workers per precinct. 3 of those are elected by the community themselves. The judges of elections and the majority and minority inspectors are elected by the people in those precincts. Sometimes there's vacancies that have to be filled. It is a challenge. During this year, we're going to have required training for those 3 individuals to go to a two-hour session. They'll be paid for that. They'll be reimbursed for that. But this is always a challenge. We haven't changed the system in about 15 years. So people were used to, not just the voters, but the poll workers, as you indicated, they were used to how the machines work to get them turned on, to get them ready. This year is going to be new. And anytime you have a new system, obviously there can be some hiccups and as you go forward.
I'm in the offices of County Executive Rich Fitzgerald. As you know, the Senate Intelligence Committee confirmed that every state was targeted in the 2016 election by Russian hackers. Are you concerned at all about the security of our local election system, at least at the county level?
Well, you're always concerned about that, and you want to put in the safeguards in place to make sure that everybody's vote is secure. And that's really the challenge of all of us. Rules that are put out by the state, by the federal government, and then the Department of State in Pennsylvania. And you move forward with the type of security that you need. One of the things I think people will feel secure is that you've got paper ballots, so people can always go back and do a recount on some of the contested races that may occur. So you're always mindful of things that can happen. We know over the history that there's sometimes irregularities around voting, and it's incumbent upon all of us to make sure we put a system in place and execute the system in place that allows everybody's vote to be counted.
What specific action can the county take, if any, regarding security? Are you relying on the work of federal agencies?
Well, no, it'll be the local workers who do this. It'll be the folks in the election departments at each of the 67 counties in Pennsylvania and then throughout the country. Obviously, you follow various laws that the congressional folks at the federal level put forward and at the state level as well. And you follow those out, but securing it so that when, for example, this year, you'll be voting on a paper ballot. You'll be putting your ballot into a scan and into a box that will be secured and locked and then taken to the depository downtown where the election department is. Those boxes will be in secure places with cameras. You go through that process in which the experts who know how to run elections go forward.
And you have enough time by April to get all that ready.
We're doing our best, and I'm really, I know we've got some real professionals who are working on that process, and, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make sure that we run a good, fair election process. I think Allegheny County over the years has a good reputation of having been able to do that, and I see no reason to why we won't do that in the future.
Looking ahead to the April primary, you obviously are a Democrat. Are there key policy points among the current lot of contenders that you think will most benefit the Pittsburgh region?
Yes, I think some of, I guess it would be considered some of our more moderate candidates who respect and, you know, are you would call them, they have democratic values for working people, for the right of people to organize, protecting our environment, investing in healthcare, investing in making sure that workers are treated fairly with a fair wage, a fair taxation system, et cetera. So yeah, there are a number of candidates: Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Mayor Bloomberg, that I think would probably fit that bill. But we'll see who emerges.
How do you balance as a leader for Southwestern Pennsylvania? Who might benefit, whose election might benefit the region as opposed to the nation as a whole? How do you put that into perspective?
I actually think they generally are the same. I think what's going to be good for Western Pennsylvania is going to be good for the rest of the country. I think Western Pennsylvania in many ways is very symbolic of and representative of what we have in the country. We have obviously a large urban area with the city of Pittsburgh. You have suburban areas surrounding the city of Pittsburgh within Allegheny County, and we have rural areas in some of our surrounding counties, the Beaver, Butler, Westmoreland, Greene, Fayette, et cetera. So I think it is in many ways a microcosm of what we have here. We have a diverse industry where we have a lot of manufacturing, we have energy, we have technology, we have robotics, artificial intelligence, eds and meds. So I think when in financial sector, et cetera. So I think when you look at our economy and the workforce that we have, I think the policies that would be put in place for Western Pennsylvania would be beneficial to the nation as a whole.
You mentioned three names: Klobuchar, Bloomberg, Biden. Are you ready to endorse one of the presidential candidates?
I will be a Biden delegate, so I know Vice President Biden, and certainly the work that he did in the Obama administration brought this country out of a very, very deep recession when they were elected back in 2008, left this country on a pretty good path as they left office in 2016. I think some of the tax policies and some of the things that have occurred have not been beneficial necessarily to us. So, but you know, whoever emerges as as our party standard bearer, I will be getting behind and supporting.
So you would vote for any Democrat, whoever emerges over Republican President Donald Trump. Is that what you're saying?
At this point, I think it would be definitely beneficial for us to make some of the changes to bring more fairness around our tax policy. I'm very concerned about the huge deficits that are being run right now. I don't think it's fair to our children and grandchildren to do some of the deficit spending that's going on. I think some of the tax breaks that have gone on for the very, very wealthy are not the right policies for us here in Western Pennsylvania. So we'll have to move forward. It's a process, and I think as the country and different states go through this process, whether it be in Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, and then we'll move on to Super Tuesday, and then ultimately we're going to come to Pennsylvania in late April. We'll see where we go.
Will Pennsylvania have much of a say by then, really?
It's hard to say. I mean, we've had some years where it has, we've had some years where it hasn't. Now you still have four, five, six candidates that are still in the running at this point. Will that winnow out at some point? Most likely. But will we be down to one candidate by the time it comes to Pennsylvania? I don't know the answer to that. My guess is probably not. There may be two, there may be three, there may be four candidates still around, so that are still viable at that point. So as we go through this process, we'll just have to see where we go.
Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald, thanks for your time.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As more officials focus their strategy on securing hard targets from hackers like voting machines and voting networks, cyber criminals have reacted by shifting their focus to soft targets or the people behind the machines. I spoke recently with Bob Jones, the special agent in charge of the FBI's Pittsburgh office, about how social media users become unsuspecting victims. I started by asking him how hackers do it.
They will flood that social media with false stories, spread disinformation to make somebody think something different about a subject that may potentially impact the way they vote.
Is it done through, shall we say, reputable news organizations? I mean, there's so many avenues for information on the web. So how do they go about doing it?
No reputable organization. These would be organizations that are made up by these many times foreign intelligence organizations to look like reputable organizations.
So what is how would you assess your relationship, federal authorities, the FBI, with social media organizations, the big ones, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera?
We have extensive outreach with those large organizations. We think in 2018 alone, we were able to remove over 1,000 different attempts by foreign organizations to, again, influence an election.
What's your approach, mate? What is your argument to say, hey, cooperate with us? It's for the betterment. Or what is your argument?
They usually accept that argument. And that's the exact argument we'll make. Hey, please help us. If you see a fake Twitter account, a fake Facebook account, please assist us in removing that from your networks. The problem with the large corporations and the large software organizations are there are just so many of them. They can only monitor so many different things through their organization. A lot of times they're just overwhelmed.
So is that it, rather than we don't want to cooperate? Because you said usually.
We've had no organization that doesn't understand the severity of the threat and that isn't cooperating with us to an extent.
What do you still need, though, from these major corporations, these social media corporations?
Just that willingness to assist us when it comes to the identification of a foreign adversary that is putting out disinformation.
Is the argument, hey, we don't want to reveal the identity, the information that we have? It's a personal thing? It's a personal rights thing, or what?
Usually not. Again, more often than not, it's just the overwhelming amount of information that we've asked these social media organizations to look at for us. And sometimes the adversary slips through.
Do I assume that this goes beyond the 2020 elections? It's other instances of maybe attacking some soft targets, whether it's, for instance, Butler County Library.
This is the world we live in now. Foreign influence operations aside, we see business email compromise, crimes, ransomware, across the spectrum, libraries, police departments, hospitals, news networks. Everybody is susceptible to these types of attacks. We are very connected with our systems, and it's the world we live in now.
So what do you tell? What advice do you give the, shall we say, smaller targets that really maybe not have the resources to beef up their own defenses? Sure. I mean, we're talking some nonprofits here, too.
Absolutely. Just basic education and understanding that they could be targeted, and then just some basic cyber hygiene techniques that they can use. Two different passwords. Make sure you have an extensive password. Don't connect the fire department's computer system with the police departments and with the hospitals so that if one is attacked with ransomware, they are all vulnerable. Make those separate systems. There are basic cyber hygiene things that can be done to harden systems.
Has that happened where one has been attacked and because they're connected to another department that they, you know, sort of work with directly, they have been therefore attacked?
Yes, we see that all the time.
Locally?
We have seen that locally.
Such as?
I'm not going to mention the organization's name, but we have seen, again, small municipalities that have interlocked systems that make separate systems vulnerable when one is attacked.
Has it been resolved? Can you say that?
We have educated those organizations to make sure that they don't operate like that in the future, and they've accepted that information and implemented it.
I mean, what can you do legally? I mean, you can advise, you can offer help, but do you follow up to see if they take your recommendations?
We don't. We can conduct an investigation. If they are hacked into, we can provide them, again, those cyber hygiene bits of information to harden their systems. But if an organization decides not to take our advice, it isn't where we go and check on them a year later to see if they're up to speed.
Whether it's a municipal target like a police department, fire department, whether it's a library, whether it's a DA's office, how difficult does it make it to secure those targets, though?
You can harden any system to make it impenetrable. However, it can be a huge draw monetarily, privacy-wise, on an organization. What we encourage is that everyone just take those basic cyber hygiene tips that we provide them to harden it, just to make it not as soft as it was in the past and make the bad guys move on to potentially another target and not theirs.
So you used the word impenetrable. Is anything truly impenetrable, though?
I can get you close, but again, we have to give the adversary a vote. They are very good at figuring out ways to intrude.
And you're just trying to get them to be discouraged and move on elsewhere to a softer target?
I don't want to bring that heat onto another organization, but I want them to look at my system and say, that's not worth attacking. We're not going to get in.
Bob Jones is the special agent in charge of Pittsburgh's Office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Bob, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, we'll answer a good question about two massive stone structures along Washington Boulevard. Plus, a new book tells the almost forgotten story of the forced evacuation of 2,000 minority Johnstown residents. And Pennsylvania fireflies could be going dark. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, artist J. Howard Miller unveils his design for the iconic We Can Do It poster in 1943. Miller studied at the Art Institute of Pittsburgh and lived in the city throughout the war. He worked at Westinghouse, where he was hired to create a series of posters for advertising. The We Can Do It poster features a woman commonly called Rosie the Riveter, flexing her arm, wearing a manufacturing uniform, and a red and white polka dot headband. Some researchers say the woman is based on Naomi Parker Fraley, but historians generally believe the woman in the poster is most likely an amalgamation of different people. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
Working overtime on the riveting machine when they gave her a production.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Two massive stone arches loom over Washington Boulevard in Pittsburgh's Homewood and Larimer neighborhoods. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley reports on why the Romanesque structures were constructed and a lake that once existed beneath them.
Good question asker Jeff from Glenshaw often drives from the North Hills into the city of Pittsburgh and noticed the giant spans near a car wash business and storage facility.
I would like to know the story behind the beautiful stone arch bridge that crosses over Washington Boulevard.
The intersecting arches over Silver Lake Drive are seemingly out of place along this curvy concrete road and tower above the speeding traffic below.
You can basically fit a seven-story building under there.
Bruce Crittlebaugh with the blog Pittsburgh Bridges says the arches were built for the Pennsylvania Railroad in 1902.
The railroad came through here because all those busy mainline tracks were converging on downtown Pittsburgh and creating a bottleneck of freight traffic.
It's called the Brilliant Viaduct.
The name Brilliant comes from an oil refinery nearby that processed oil from the boom that was going on up north in Titusville. It was one of the first refineries in the world and led to the creation of the Standard Oil Company.
The Pennsylvania Railroad's chief engineer at the time had a thing for stone, so many of the company's bridges have a similar elaborate, colossal feel as the Brilliant Viaduct. Around the same time, streams flowed freely into Negley Run and down to the Allegheny River. These have since been filled in or covered over by roadways, but back then, a man named George Finley owned the land. He built a dam across one of them and started farming carp. Christine Mondor is a principal at Evolve Environment Architecture, a firm that's been working in Larimer and Homewood and knows a lot about the region's water history. She says Finley even wrote a book about carp farming at Silver Lake.
And he talks about how it's an economic driver and how he had to figure out how to make it not flood, and how it was beautiful, but also very functional.
Neighbors also enjoyed the lake, and it was a popular ice skating spot in the winter.
If you look you can see postcards from back in the day, and you see people who are dressed in their Sunday best looking over a lake that's underneath these big stone viaducts.
Around the turn of the century, the City Department of Public Works director was crafting Pittsburgh's parks into a sprawling connected system. This was around the time Schenley and Highland Parks were developed into what they are today. The city decided to replace a separate bridge along Lincoln Avenue over Silver Lake with an equally extravagant stone span. And that's what people see today. Two intersecting structures towering over trees and cars. But for Pittsburgh residents, the name Silver Lake doesn't bring memories of water, but of movies.
I could sit in my bedroom window and look out and see the movie.
After the Great Depression, the lake was filled in and transformed into a 550-car movie theater. Wanda Matthews graduated from the nearby Westinghouse High School in 1970 and lived up the hill from the Silver Lake drive-in.
Sometimes you could hear it, depending on the surrounding noise, and sometimes you couldn't.
She says families would pack up their vehicles with kids and blankets and snacks and visit the drive-in. The giant arches did seem somewhat out of place against the modern film setting, she says, but most people didn't remember the lake. The drive-in closed in 1968. The area is now overgrown with bushes peeking through the concrete. But the arches are a reminder that at its industrial peak, all parts of the city were bustling with commerce and manufacturing. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Good Question is a regular feature on 90.5 WESA, where we investigate what you've always wondered about Pittsburgh. Check out more of the stories and submit something of your own at wesa.fm/goodquestion. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In September 1923, in response to the shooting deaths of police officers by one black resident, the mayor of Johnstown orders 2,000 African Americans and Mexicans to leave town within 24 hours. But that injustice has largely faded from memory. A new book asks why. Cody McDevitt, a journalist with the Somerset Daily American, has written Banished from Johnstown. Cody, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
People certainly remember the Johnstown flood, 1889. Why don't we, or do we choose not to, remember the banishment of 2,000 minority residents?
I think the answer is twofold. For the white community, I think it was a source of shame and embarrassment. And there's a tendency of local historians, not just in Western Pennsylvania, but all across the country, to portray themselves off as heroes and to highlight hardships that they've overcome, heroic deeds, that sort of thing. And this is obviously not a heroic deed. This is a source of shame and embarrassment for the community. Mm-hmm. And then I think for the black community, they were ethnically intimidated into silence.
Were they afraid of reprisals if they brought it up?
Yeah, that's. I spoke to an African American preacher about that, and he said they feared retribution, revenge. Those stories were not really discussed, and then as a result, the oral tradition was largely lost.
Little background, Johnstown had a solid African-American community for many decades. Why was it increased by World War I?
During that time, what was known as the Great Migration started. That was the travel of African-Americans from southern plantations to work in northern industrial centers, and they were recruited by steel mill executives to work there because of the labor shortage.
How did the community react when this influx of newcomers arrived?
There was a tendency in local media and in just the community in old Johnstown, as it was known, which was the longtime Johnstown population, to criminalize these newcomers. So you'll see headlines where they identify the person's race, and then they say that there's a crime wave coming. And they also mention Mexicans as well. So they were linked to this influx of crime. And so they were seen as dangerous people who murdered, raped. And so there was a suspicion and a fear of these newcomers.
We're talking to author and reporter Cody McDevitt. Cody, the incident at the heart of your book involved one African-American who was intoxicated in a shootout with police. Four officers wound up dying as a result. You report that people wanted to believe that there were multiple gunmen, even a riot. Why?
It was just kind of how the newspapers reported it at the time, that they wanted to blame the entire black community for what happened. Mm-hmm. And that's largely what they did.
Especially the person at the center of your book, the mayor, Joseph Caulfield. He orders blacks and Mexicans who lived in Johnstown for less than 7 years to get out, basically by sundown. That 7 years, of course, that includes the influx of the newcomers mm-hmm. from the Great War. What was the or else part of that order? Leave, or what would happen to you?
Oh, a lot of people have forgotten this part of legal history in Pennsylvania. Mayors could serve as magistrates as well. So his threat of imprisonment and heavy fines was largely what he could do. I mean, he could bring people before court, and then he'd say, all right, you get this much time in jail. And so as a result of them fearing imprisonment, they left. And there was also, he had a private police force, and so there's evidence that he would use it to coerce people to do what he wanted.
A private police force. So are you saying the official police force of Johnstown didn't agree with him, or what?
Well, he was kind of reviled and despised among other public officials, including the police chief at the time. But he paid police officers to do what he wanted them to do in their off time. Whether or not he ordered them to go through these communities and then just kind of, in no uncertain terms, coerce them to leave is something that's a matter of conjecture.
What was his reasoning, or at least what did he tell people at the time why he was taking this action?
He said it was for the African-American community's own good. He feared for their safety. That's one of the things he said. But the ulterior motive was that he was running for re-election, and there was a significant Klan vote there.
Was Caulfield a member of the Klan?
There's a suspicion that he was. In the secondary sources that I found, there was an indication that he was a member of the Klan. At least that was one of the things that was a rumor spreading in the community.
Our guest on The Confluence is journalist Cody McDevitt. His new book, Banished from Johnstown, is out now. Despite editorials and papers across the country, including Pittsburgh Courier, a renowned African-American newspaper based here in Pittsburgh, you write that Caulfield wouldn't back down. He said, quote, "I am not going to stand idle and allow the South to dump its criminals and riffraff into Johnstown," end quote. Strong words. Why wasn't the mayor challenged legally?
There was a lot of people in Johnstown that hated the publicity that this was bringing, which was largely driven by the African-American press. But he was defiant, and he felt that he was going to win the primary and the election because he just felt that criminalizing these African-Americans and ordering them to leave was a winning political move.
Oh, hold it. Now, they hated the publicity. Did they hate his action, though?
The Johnstown Democrat,
which was the more liberal newspaper?
It was the Democratic newspaper. There was a lot of political shifts during that time, but the Republican newspaper was the Johnstown Tribune, which was largely more conservative. But the difference in the newspapers reporting, the Democrat said it basically grounded its criticism in civil rights and justice language, whereas the Johnstown Tribune criticized it for the publicity.
Deputy Attorney General did a cursory investigation. What went wrong with it? What did it turn up?
Well, I mean, you look at what this guy did, what Caulfield did, and, you know, it's something for grounds for impeachment and removal for office. That's what a lot of people were pushing for, including the NAACP. But the investigation largely went there, and it found a lot of things that he would bring people before court. That his there were those abuses of mayor's courts, as it was known. But it didn't really remove him from office, didn't call for that. And it sort of, I don't want to say whitewashed what happened, but the governor at the time, Gifford Pinchot, who was known as a progressive Republican, was also friends with Caulfield. So he served out his term, was replaced by Louis Frank, and then he was also reelected at a later point as well.
Well, let's get to that. He actually lost reelection within weeks, right? After this incident, but he was elected again.
Yeah, I mean you try to find the redemption story for Johnstone, in which case it didn't vote for him in the primary. It didn't fall for the political play. But then 4 years later, a similar situation happens. An African American kills police officers, and then he runs for re-election as an independent. And then he gets reelected for another four-year term before going to jail for corruption.
He winds up in prison.
Yeah, and he was known as a very corrupt person. But and then when he died, he was given kind of the statesman-like treatment by local newspapers. They said, yeah, he was a warrior. He fought for what he believed in, which is also kind of a source of, you have to really reevaluate the way that Johnstone perceived this incident because of its treatment of the primary villain in the story.
And the 2,000 people, where did they go?
Most went west. That likely meant they went to Pittsburgh.
About a year. I think it was about a year after this incident. There was an editorial in a Philadelphia newspaper said where they finally went, no one seems to know or care.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the attitude? I mean, the no, okay, but the care?
Yeah, I mean, I think people didn't really see the human aspect. I mean, if you imagine if that happened today, there would be so many interviews with the people that were affected. But then, and at least according to the secondary sources that I found, there really wasn't any specific interest in the individual stories of these people, which is what I'm trying to tell with my Rosedale Oral History Project, is the individual stories of the people affected, what happened to them, and then what impact did it have for the community to lose those individuals.
Have the current leaders of Johnstown responded to your book? Have they acknowledged what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think local historians, local businessmen, prominent people in obviously the African American community has been supportive of the effort. I mean, on Facebook, because I've advertised the book, there's been some people that have said, you know, boy, don't stir trouble, or, you know, there's some that say that this book should be burned. But given that it's an election year, these types of stories and people politicize history, there's a lot of trolls online, but I think by and large, the community has supported the effort. And I don't want to have one of these narratives that Johnstone is more racist than every other community in the country. I mean, it gets those reputations with those articles that are written by national publications, by journalists who spend a week there. But the truth of its racial sensibilities is far more nuanced in this day and age.
Cody McDevitt is a reporter with the Somerset Daily American. He's the author of Banished from Johnstown. Cody, thanks so much for coming in.
No problem.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Quick quiz. Do you know what Pennsylvania's state insect is? John Hayes, outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, is here to illuminate us and let us know if this bug has a dim future. John, welcome back to The Confluence.
That was so cool. I love the way you slid that in there.
Try to be subtle, but I wasn't. So the state bug, the answer is?
The lightning bug or the firefly, I guess, depending on where you grew up.
Well, good. At least you accept my name for it, the lightning bug, because that's what I knew it as when I grew up. So there are many species of ants, spiders, for example. What about fireflies? Lots of those?
I didn't know there were 2,000 species of bioluminescent fireflies, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You write that these summertime staples are in danger. What's the source of the threat?
The impetus for the story was a Tufts University study released last week that that chronicled all of the threats to fireflies, mostly pesticides and habitat loss. But one in particular was light pollution, which really caught my attention, particularly because a lot of the study about lightning bug light pollution was done in western Pennsylvania.
And so did you talk to those researchers and what they are looking for?
I talked to the person who runs the Pennsylvania Firefly Festival in June, every June. In 2011, some campers in Allegheny National Forest noticed a bunch of fireflies blinking in unison. Now, the only lightning bugs that blink in unison are supposed to be at one location in Tennessee and Malaysia.
Oh, my.
They happened to know this and told a firefly researcher from Tennessee who brought back up to Forest County a whole bunch of Tennessee firefly investigators who confirmed this.
So how do the researchers know that artificial light is stressing the fireflies?
The research was in various parts. The part on the bioluminescence, I guess, I don't think there was clinical study. Mm-hmm. I think it was just observational study, and a lot of it was done at this festival. The right. researchers came to Forest County and actually did some of the research.
So stress also affects bugs. The fireflies use their bioluminescence to attract other fireflies.
To communicate, right.
Yeah. Do the bright lights interfere with their mating and therefore the continuation of their species?
Yeah. I guess they can't see each other or can't make out the sequence of flashes, which is code for their communication between right. males and females.
Mm-hmm.
So being right beside a big billboard that is lighted or the light in your backyard or something like that disrupts their ability to see the light.
So what about suburban and rural areas further away from Pittsburgh? Are fireflies safer there than the city and the big lights or not?
Well, in the city where there used to be grass and there's now a big parking lot, that's habitat loss. In the rural areas where there's a lot of pesticides, they're being impacted by that. I know that one thing that surprised me about this story was that firefly tourism globally draws some 200,000 people, and they believe that the actual just walking in that area on the grass is a threat to the fireflies because people are stepping on their larvae.
Where are people coming from to tour firefly sites?
I read that firefly tourism is really big in the Far East.
The Far East.
And in Pennsylvania, there's this one festival that I know of. And once they drew 1,000 people in one night to this one location, they started worrying about it too. So they started booking firefly festivals elsewhere. There's going to be one in Ohio Powell this year and one in Slippery Rock.
All right. We have just a minute left. Aside from their beauty, the sense of nostalgia that that they create, inspire among us, what's the importance to the ecosystem?
You know, ecosystem all works together. If this one insect is stressed, it's an indicator species. So if it's stressed, other insects are stressed too. We may see it more in lightning bugs because when you look in your backyard and you don't see as many as you did before, you know there's a problem with the lightning bugs, whereas there may be other insects you can't tell what's going on with them.
John Hayes is the outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. John, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you would like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.